I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
British officials confirmed today that they have lost communication with three ships on a routine mission in the waters between Iraq and Iran. Iranian television reported that the small patrol boats were seized and eight British crew arrested by Iranian forces. We spoke earlier with BBC correspondent Jim Moore in Tehran and asked him what the British embassy there was saying.
They're saying essentially that, yes, the command in Iraq lost contact with these three boats, which were out on a training patrol with the Iraqi customs. Now, obviously, they're training the Iraqis to patrol that waterway, the Shatt al-Arab, which provides the border between Iraq and Iran. The border is historically disputed, and what seems to have happened, certainly according to the Iranians, is that the three boats strayed across the line into what Iran at least regards as its territorial waters. Were intercepted by Iranian naval units, taken under escort to the Iranian side of the coastline, and where they are being interrogated now.
Well, remind us, what makes this a particularly contentious time between Iran and Britain?
Well, it's always a delicate relationship for historical reasons, but it has got extremely complicated and very sensitive in recent months, and there have been many hardline demonstrations outside the British embassy here because of Britain's role in Iraq. Britain, of course, being a major coalition partner, is singled out as the main target here for demonstrations simply because there is no US embassy. The old US embassy has long been in Iranian hands since 1979, so Britain is the obvious target. That's one issue. There's also the nuclear issue on which Britain, along with France and Germany, has been playing a leading role, including shaping that IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency resolution last week, which was pretty tough on Iran, plus, of course, spearheading on human rights too. So there are many issues between the two countries, and that makes this a particularly sensitive moment for this incident to happen.
What's your sense of it, though? These are three small boats, eight crewmen. Is your sense that this is possibly tempest in teapot, Iran making a statement, or is there something bigger looming?
I think it depends how long it goes on. If it had been settled locally and on the kind of military technical level, I think that would have happened quite quickly and it could have passed off as a minor incident. If it now gets snarled up in the kind of complex political ramifications that we've been talking about just now, it could well become quite a protracted issue and become another issue between the countries, as well as being complicated by the other issues I was talking about. So it's really hard to say at this stage. If it was a simple navigation error and the Brits admit it, it could be solved quite quickly. But if the Iranians at least can pretend to have a suspicion that they were on some kind of darker mission, then of course the hardliners here would press for this thing to be protracted and for the Brits to be held for quite some time.
Jim, very briefly, Iran's supreme leader today said that his country wasn't seeking nuclear weapons. He reiterated that and vowed that they won't give up the program to enrich uranium for fuel for use in nuclear reactors. Any tie between the statement and the seizing of the patrol boats?
I think not really. I mean, this is a standard Iranian position that Iran is not after nuclear weapons, but does demand the right to enrich fuel and use it for peaceful power production purposes. So that's a standard line. But Iran is playing quite tough at the moment on the nuclear front as well as on other fronts. There has been a shift to the right in Iranian politics with the February elections, which saw conservatives return to parliament in a large majority. So there is a general stiffening of the spine here, and that may make it a little bit more difficult to sort this problem of the three boats out in a quick and satisfactory manner from the British point of view.
Jim Muir, correspondent for the BBC. He spoke to us from Tehran. Jim, thank you.
You're most welcome.
With a little more than a week to go now before the turnover of sovereignty, Iraq's new prime minister says he may impose a state of emergency that could include curfews and a ban on public demonstrations. Also in Iraq today, an American military judge has ruled that Abu Ghraib prison may not be torn down because it's a crime scene. And South Korea says it will send troops to Iraq despite the capture of a South Korean translator who was shown on television pleading for his life. There are unconfirmed reports that 10 other foreigners are being held with him. Ann Barnard covers Iraq for the Boston Globe. She joins us on the line from Baghdad. Welcome, Ann.
Hi, thanks very much.
And the violence is continuing today. We're hearing reports now that 4 Iraqi citizens have been killed in a roadside bomb south of Mosul, 2 Iraqi soldiers killed in Baghdad yesterday. Fair to say that that's the kind of continuing violence that the prime minister is trying to alleviate by imposing a state of emergency?
Yes, very much so. Security is certainly the top concern for all Iraqis now. Everyone you ask says all they want is for the government to bring things under control. Every day you worry if there's going to be another car bomb or another roadside bomb. And the measures that may sound draconian to an American ear actually sound great to almost every Iraqi I've talked to, no matter how much they may have at one point been predisposed to a more liberal democracy. Even my Arabic teacher this morning was all excited because the Minister of Defense over the weekend said that he plans to cut off the heads and the hands of the people that are exploding the car bombs. He said, this is what we need, an Iraqi leader who makes a strong statement.
Well, how different would a state of emergency be from what people are experiencing now?
You know, there would be important differences and important similarities. In a sense, we are under martial law in that the American military is the ultimate arbiter right now, but there is no curfew. There is right now no limits on who can come in out of the country as long as they have a passport. There is a sense that the streets are not under tight control. The one problem is when Iraqi authorities talk about imposing martial law, they don't have an army that is independent. So in some sense, it's more rhetorical than real.
Well, moving on to these pretrial hearings now for the soldiers who've been charged in the prison abuse scandal, what's the latest?
It was quite a day, actually. The 3 defendants that were in pretrial hearings today were denied the opportunity to move their trials out of Iraq. They had argued that they had not been able to have access to witnesses provided by the military. The judge was not very receptive to that, but probably the most interesting thing that happened today is the judge ruled that they could question top military commanders. And they're one of the defense lawyers who also is trying a murder case in southern New Jersey right now, a very colorful man, said that he would take his case all the way up to the top and even call the president in an attempt to prove that these were not 7 military police acting alone, that in fact torture was policy.
And as you can imagine, the news of the South Korean translator who's being held hostage in Baghdad is getting a lot of attention here, especially after Friday's beheading of the American hostage, Paul Johnson, in Saudi Arabia. Do we know who's holding this latest hostage and what they want?
Well, in the videotape that was broadcast on Al Jazeera, the kidnappers identified themselves as being affiliated with Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, who is a Jordanian that the United States says has links to al-Qaeda. The demands are that the Koreans get out of Iraq. And, in fact, you may have seen the footage of the man pleading with his country to keep the soldiers out of Iraq, and the president of South Korea has said, no, we're not going to bend to these demands.
Anne, thank you.
Thanks very much.
Anne Bernard reports on Iraq for the Boston Globe. She joined us on the line from Baghdad.
Well, the Arabic satellite news channel Al Jazeera was the first to air the taped image of the South Korean hostage pleading for his life yesterday. In a recent survey, most Iraqis said they rely on both Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya for their news. As Iraqis prepare to take control, we thought we'd check in with Steve Negus in Baghdad. He monitors Iraqi media for the London-based Institute for War and Peace Reporting. And first of all, Steve, do you agree that most Iraqis get their news from Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya?
Yes, they do. Al Arabiya and Al Jazeera tend to be the first on the scene. They have the most compelling footage. While quite a few Iraqis don't agree with the Al Jazeera's worldview, they tend to watch it rather compulsively.
What wouldn't they agree with?
Well, some people perceive that Al Jazeera had a overly positive view of the Saddam Hussein regime. Early on, a lot of Iraqi Shia saw Al Jazeera as being overly representative of sort of Sunni Arab nationalist viewpoints. This has changed to a certain extent with the April uprising, in which Shia attitudes and Sunni attitudes sort of converge quite a bit. Mm. But there still is a gap. I mean, people do sort of perceive Al Jazeera in particular as having an Arab nationalist viewpoint to which they don't necessarily ascribe.
Well, the Bush administration has said that Al Jazeera is propagandist. From your watching of it, is it?
No, I mean, it tends to be somewhat sensationalist. It tends to take a very uncritical view. So, you know, very often when you have, you know, an explosion in a city, you'll have all kinds of eyewitnesses telling you all kinds of things about there's an American helicopter passing overhead or an airplane or, you know, so many dozens of people were killed. Al Jazeera will report these somewhat uncritically. Sometimes the language they use is, you know, they refer to anti-coalition insurgents as the resistance, which some Iraqis think has unnecessarily positive connotations. It has an agenda, but I wouldn't characterize it as propaganda.
Interested in how Iraqis are responding to some of the news in light of the upcoming handover of power. The interim government has said it may impose martial law if necessary. How are Iraqis responding to that?
My impression is the general state of public opinion would probably accept an awful lot from a government if it can improve the security situation. Also, you know, we've got troops in the streets already, which have, you know, are empowered to use deadly force against civilians and, you know, detentions without trial. It's difficult to see how martial law would be all that much different.
Yeah. What about the recently launched U.S.-funded satellite news channel Al-Hurra, which is produced in outside of Washington, D.C.? Do Iraqis watch it, and do they trust it?
Yeah, they do. They trust it to a certain extent. There's been very positive comments about it. It's still the Arab satellite stations, meaning Al Arabiya and Al Jazeera, tend to be sort of quicker on the spot with more compelling footage. My colleagues, no matter what their views on the coalition are more likely to have watched Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya than Al Hurra.
And just briefly, Steve, how important is a national media, including newspapers, going to be with the upcoming handover of power?
Well, quite important. I mean, the newspapers, not a lot of people read them. But they do. They can cover, you know, Iraqi politics in a much more detailed way than the TV stations can. One other thing to keep in mind is that my impression is that even though Iraqis have access to all kinds of different media, you know, they've always been skeptical of the media ever since, you know, the days of Saddam. You sort of, you know, you knew not to believe what you saw on TV or read in the papers. Even though most media here does have some sort of agenda, I think the role of the media in shaping public opinion is perhaps a bit overrated. People can make up their own minds.
Steve, thank you.
My pleasure.
Steve Negus, a Baghdad-based editor for the Institute for War and Peace Reporting.
Just ahead, another view from Iraq. We'll hear from the voice of the CPA in Baghdad, the Deputy Director of Coalition Operations, Brigadier General Mark Kimmett.
And later, one of the most powerful men on Capitol Hill is accused of abuse of power. Partisan politics, business as usual, or is Republican leader Tom DeLay in for a fall?
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
As we said earlier, four more American troops were killed in the Sunni Muslim stronghold of Ramadi today, as controversy continues about the Saturday airstrikes that the U.S. military says killed key figures in Fallujah in the network of suspected terrorist Abu al-Zarqawi. Well, moments ago, we spoke from Baghdad with the Deputy Director of Coalition Operations, Brigadier General Mark Kimmett, about what he expects might happen between now and the June 30th scheduled transfer of sovereignty there. We began by asking him about the latest deaths in Ramadi.
About noon today, we did not get reports from a group of soldiers conducting a mission inside the town of Ramadi. We sent a quick reaction force to their location because these were a series of reports that we should have gotten as routine information. When the quick reaction force got to the location, they discovered four service members who had been killed, apparently in a confrontation with anti-Iraqi forces.
I wonder if you could tell us more about the Saturday airstrikes in Fallujah, in which the reports were that suspected terrorist Abu al-Zarqawi had been killed. There are other reports from the Fallujah Brigade that say, well, no, they believe that only women and children were killed. Can you clear up some of that discrepancy for us?
Sure. We conducted a strike on a known Zarqawi network location in the town of Fallujah. Clear evidence pointing to that being a location where the network operated out of. There was never any question that this was a place where they've been building bombs, storing ammunition, conducting operations out of. Now, whether Abu Musab al-Zarqawi was at that location, I don't think that that was the target as much as it was members of his network. The pre-strike intelligence and the post-strike intelligence indicates to us that there was a significant amount of ammunition being stored there, the number of multiples and secondary explosions that went on for a long period of time clearly indicated that there was a lot of ammunition at that location. I can't accredit what the Fallujah Brigade said or didn't say. All I can tell you is that the head of the National Security Council here, Mufaq Rabai, was very adamant that he believed that that was a known Zarqawi location and was appreciative to the coalition for conducting that strike.
General, we're also hearing today from Iraq's new interim government, its prime minister, that they may impose a state of emergency there involving curfews and a ban on public demonstrations. What can you tell us about that in terms of how might that look different from the way Iraq is right now?
Well, the way it would be different is that these would be operations carried out by the Iraqi government. Prime Minister Designate Alawi is very firm that security is top on his agenda, and if it takes extraordinary measures such as curfews, such as additional checkpoints at places such as Baghdad, that he's willing to do that to protect his nation.
And is it your belief that Iraqis might accept that more readily coming from an interim government run by Iraqis than they have from American forces?
Well, it is clear that the Iraqis have understood why we are doing it, but of course it's going to be far more understandable and far more accepted if those types of measures are taken by one of their own.
And with a week now to go before sovereignty is transferred, what do you expect to happen in these next few days?
Well, I'll tell you, I'd like to say we're going to be seeing nothing but celebrations and people walking the streets, enjoying themselves and celebrating their rights that they're gaining under sovereignty. Sadly, I think the terrorists still believe that they have an opportunity to derail this process. I think it's going to be fairly unstable the way it has been over the past few weeks. But nonetheless, we will proceed with handing sovereignty over to the people of Iraq. The destiny belongs to them, their rights belong to them, and we're not going to allow terrorists and former Saddam elements to stop them from getting the same privileges and enjoying the same rights and human rights that we enjoy as Americans every day.
And we're told, General, that there won't be big ceremonies transferring power. Will there be anything to mark the occasion, the change between June 30th and July 1st?
Well, I think we're going to see some modest, respectful ceremonies, but we have always operated under the assumption that this nation belongs to the people of Iraq, and I don't think we want to somehow look like we're giving them their nation back. This is their nation, and I know Ambassador Bremer doesn't want to look like he has owned it and now he's giving it back. There may be some sort of respectful ceremony during that time period. But I don't think that you're going to see any grandiose transfer of authority because there's nothing to transfer. This is their nation. We will continue to respect it as their nation, and we'll continue to support it as the nation of Iraq.
And, of course, the question that many Americans want to know is, what's your best guess as to when the majority of American forces might be coming home?
Well, I think we're going to be measuring that in months, not weeks or days. There will be some time that it will take to build up the Iraqi security forces so that they can take responsibility for their own defense needs, both internal and external. And I know that we have some of the best officers in the United States military working that training, fielding, and equipping. But it will take some time, and we remain convinced that not only the people of Iraq, but the people of America understand and are willing to commit the time it takes to get this done right.
But months as opposed to years?
Months as opposed to years, but I think we will need some time to do this right. We will not stay here one day longer than necessary, but we will not leave one day sooner than necessary.
And finally, General, when do you get to come home?
I will probably be returning to the States sometime in July for a follow-on assignment, which will involve most of my time, at least half my time, being spent in Qatar continuing to support this operation. But I hope to see my family in July, move down to Tampa, then continue whatever the Army needs me to be doing.
General, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Brigadier General Mark Kimmett spoke with us moments ago from Baghdad. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
One of the most powerful men in Congress is accused of bribery, extortion, fraud, money laundering, and abuse of power. The accused is Tom DeLay, House Republican Majority Leader. The accuser, Chris Bell, a Democratic member of the House from DeLay's home state of Texas. DeLay says the accusations are without substance, vicious, and partisan. But he's also the subject of a grand jury investigation back home in Texas for possible violations of a campaign finance law. Well, joining us on the line from Austin, Texas, is Lou DeBose. His forthcoming book on Tom DeLay is called The Hammer. And Lou, the title is telling. Remind us briefly about DeLay's reputation on the Hill.
He comes by his reputation honestly. He earned it the old-fashioned way, twisting arms, intimidating opponents, threatening to recruit primary opponents against fellow Republicans if they don't vote the right way, withholding funds, withholding projects, screaming at people. He's a master. He is a relentless, ruthless master of the political process in the House.
And some people who are his followers say that's a good thing. We're reminded of the Medicaid voting, where Tom DeLay was reportedly so insistent that a House member actually hid in a closet. But another said at that time that House leaders had dangled a $100,000 bribe, actually a contribution to that House member's son's campaign. And that is also being investigated. But is Tom DeLay a target of that investigation?
Not directly, Robin. But he's got plenty of other problems.
Well, let's get to those. Chris Bell is the member who went before the House Ethics Committee with accusations against Mr. DeLay. Can you remind us specifically what those accusations are?
Yeah. What the accusations are is at the heart of this is breaking a Texas state law by spending corporate money on election of Texas state officials. The PAC that he founded clearly broke the law. They reported to the IRS that they spent $600,000 in corporate contributions, some of which were almost extorted out of companies, actually. Companies outside of Texas were pouring money into this Texas race because Tom DeLay was asking for it. So they spent this money, and they won. They achieved the redistricting. Redrew the state lines. Tom DeLay redrew the state lines himself. The maps were drawn in DeLay's office to pick up 5 to 7 Republican seats. The other mistake they made is they underestimated a Texas district attorney by the name of Ronnie Earl. The Republicans control all the courts, the Supreme Court, the Court of Criminal Appeals. They control the House, the Senate, all the, you know, governor, lieutenant governor, attorney general. Everyone's Republican. But this Ronnie Earl here in Travis County, which is where the state capital is in Austin, Ronnie Earl takes his job seriously. He has a mandate from the legislature and a budget from the legislature to prosecute political corruption, and they didn't think he would do it.
Well, now you use the word mistake. How big a mistake is it? I mean, let's back up and say as well that Chris Bell, who is the one bringing these accusations before the House Ethics Committee, is one of the congressmen who lost his seat because of the redistricting. He's white. He was redistricted to a largely black district.
Right.
He lost the nomination and his seat. We all remember when the Killer D's tried to prevent this redistricting, the Democrats fled across the border. From Texas to Oklahoma, was it, to try to avoid the redistricting. Is this just payback from Chris Bell?
Robin, you know, I think in this case there is an element of payback, but there's also an attempt to vindicate what happened. Mr. Bell will be replaced. Chris Bell will be replaced. He lost his seat, but, you know, he began to look at the facts, and they really don't pass the smell test, even in Texas. I mean, this is a state where you can write a check. You could write a check today for $50,000 to any candidate that you wanted, as long as you disclose it. But corporations can't do it. And they orchestrated this corporate spending, and it's pretty clear that it's illegal.
Well, let's just briefly a little bit about Tom DeLay. He got his start in politics because he ran an exterminating business and hated the EPA regulations on pesticides. He wanted to go to Washington and change that kind of government regulation. What else do we know about the man that may play out and how this story plays out?
Myrex. Robin, the political, the one chemical that they took away from him, the EPA banned because they found it carcinogenic and all sorts of other problems. It's a bioaccumulative hazard, a health hazard. He went on a crusade when they took Myrex away from him because it was used to kill fire ants. What we've learned about him since: smart, tenacious, knows how to use the political system. Bold, obviously, from what he did in Texas, came down and redrew the state lines and said, I'm the majority leader and I need more seats. That's why I'm doing it. Inspires loyalty in his followers and also inspires fear. A very unlikely candidate when he was, you know, 3 sessions in the state house here in Texas, and he was a nobody.
In fact, Tom DeLay had quite a reputation when he was in Texas.
He found religion when he went to Congress, but here in Austin, when we all knew and loved him as Hot Tub Tommy, the guy who lived with 3 other legislators in the house called Macho Manor. The best parties in town were at Macho Manor. Then, you know, he went and he was elected after 3 sessions here in 84. He caught the Reagan wave, the Ronald Reagan wave, was elected to Congress for the first time in an open seat, and walked into Frank Wolf's office from Virginia, the congressman from Virginia, and was given the James Dobson Focus on the Family video about family and religion. And at that moment, he came to Jesus and really focused. I mean, he wasn't getting drunk every night anymore. 1, he had more time on his hands. And 2, he found a purpose in life. And, you know, then the Republicans won they won the House in 1994. He was not supposed to win. He had opposed Newt Gingrich. He won it on his own by the old-fashioned way, by spending more money on elections than anyone else. He handed out money to freshmen running that year, and he inspired their loyalty with cash. They supported him. He was elected whip. Then, 2 years ago, he was elected majority leader. You know, the guy's running the show. He's the single most powerful member of Congress. Congress all over, because the Senate doesn't concentrate power the way the House does.
You've actually said that Tom DeLay has the largest funding combine ever controlled by a single member of Congress, something like raising $12.6 million in 2 years. So what do you think is going to happen?
I think Mr. DeLay's in trouble. There's not time for us to go into the various other scandals, but there are others, one of which John McCain is looking at, which involves DeLay Associates raising $45 million over a year and a half for lobbying fees from Indian tribes for which they got nothing. I think that we're in for after the presidential election and things settle down, we're in for a protracted examination of Tom DeLay and his funding.
So you take a fairly negative view of Tom DeLay's future, but some would say you have a partisan outlook yourself.
I guess we have a dog in the hunt. You know, we wrote a critical book about him. But you know, Robin, it's all based on the record. You know, we didn't, fortunately, as Texas journalists, you don't have to make anything up. We didn't have to make a thing up. But I would also like to see, in the end, a fair process that looks at him and looks at his fundraising and looks at it in light of the new McCain-Feingold campaign finance law.
Lou, thanks.
Thank you.
Lou DuBose, author of the forthcoming book, The Hammer, Tom DeLay, God, Guns, and Money.
Still to come, Connecticut Governor John Rowland is reportedly planning to resign later today.
And the Puerto Rican big band, Plena Libre.
You're listening to Here and Now. Whitewater, the economy, Osama bin Laden, and, of course, Monica Lewinsky. Former President Bill Clinton writes about the highs and lows of his years in the White House and more in his autobiography, My Life. The book arrives in stores tomorrow, and last night on 60 Minutes, Bill Clinton sat down for an interview with Dan Rather, who pressed him for more details about the Lewinsky affair.
In your book, you write about how furious Mrs. Clinton was when she found out the truth. How did you tell her?
I had a sleepless night and woke her up and sat down on the side of the bed and just told her. And it was awful. But I had to do it because the grand jury testimony was coming up and I was going to tell the truth to the grand jury. And I wanted her to know before it happened. I mean, I had to tell her.
And what did she say? What did she do?
Well, I don't want to go into the details. She was angry and she was mad, and she was as mad about me not telling her before, I think, as almost as mad that I hadn't told her about it as what I'd done.
So, is this long-awaited 957-page book a must-read in Washington? Peter Kanellis is Washington Bureau Chief for the Boston Globe. He joins us from Washington. And, Peter, very few people have had the chance to read the book yet, but what's the buzz you're hearing in Washington? Is everyone putting it on their nightside table and plan to reach for it as quickly as possible?
Well, I think it'll be a book that everybody will buy. The real question is whether everybody's going to read it once they've bought it. And I don't think we'll know that until at least a few more days go by. And some of us have read the reviews and heard the advance word, which is kind of mixed, which makes me think that it will have a huge advance sale, but that it'll sort of die away pretty quickly.
Well, the New York Times reviewer, as you know, wasn't very impressed. The word there was sloppy, self-indulgent, and often eye-crossingly dull, hurriedly written, and even more hurriedly edited. So is the moral of the story here, take your time, and can you think of any reason why he didn't?
Well, Clinton, you know, I think as the review also pointed out, Clinton kind of behaved that way in the White House and still managed to be compelling at times. So there's a chance that even a undisciplined work of nonfiction by Bill Clinton will be quite interesting for people.
Well, and when he was in the White House, I'm sure you remember that he was a great fundraiser for conservative groups, and one group even ran ads during the 60 Minutes program against Clinton. How much, if any, impact do you think this book's going to have on this election year?
I think it's hard to tell, and it sort of depends on how it plays out. So far, the focus has been largely on Monica Lewinsky and on the Clinton scandals, and if anything, that helps Bush a little bit because it reminds people of what they did not like about Bill Clinton. On the other hand, if the spin sort of starts to turn and Clinton starts to talk about other things, such as what he would have done differently from Bush in the wake of 9/11 and his efforts to build an international coalition around foreign policy and standing up for human rights, then it provides a kind of favorable to the Democrats contrast with Bush and can help carry a little bit.
Well, and in fact, he does remain very popular among many Democrats, and Kerry has said he thinks he's an asset. He wants Clinton to campaign for him and with him.
You know, I think more fundamentally, Kerry, since securing the nomination, has brought Clinton's advisors on board. And I think that Kerry will openly advocate a sort of return to Clintonism, albeit in a very different form.
Hmm. Peter, thank you.
Thank you.
Peter Kanellis is Washington Bureau Chief for the Boston Globe.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
The lawyer for Connecticut Governor John Rowland says the governor will announce his resignation later today. Joining us on the phone from the State House in Hartford is Ebong Udoma, a reporter with public radio station WSHU. And Ebong, the governor's lawyer is saying that Rowland will go on TV tonight and make this announcement around 6 o'clock. Is that also what you're hearing?
Yes, it is, and it has also been confirmed by the head of the Republicans in the state Senate, Senator Louis DeLuca. He spoke with me a short while ago, and he confirmed that he had spoken with the governor, and the governor will be resigning tonight.
And just remind us briefly about the governor's problems.
Well, the governor has been under investigation for accepting gifts from friends and politically connected friends and state contractors. And he denied that he had received any of these gifts.
So why is he now resigning?
Well, he later on admitted that he had lied, but maintained that those friends got nothing in return.
So, and this is happening today because?
Because apparently he is to testify before the impeachment panel that was put together by the state assembly. And he had tried to avoid it, and he went all the way to the state Supreme Court, and the state Supreme Court ruled against him on Friday. So apparently the governor got together with his lawyers and decided that he would not come and testify because there's a federal investigation, a federal corruption investigation that he's also facing.
All right, Ebong, thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
Ebong Udoma is a reporter for WSHU in Connecticut.
In Spanish, plena libre means free form or liberated. Plena libre is also the name of a 12-member band from Puerto Rico. The music of Plena Libre. The group is celebrating its 10th anniversary with its 10th record release, Estamos Gozando. And here and now's impassioned Latin music critic Jose Maso is in the studio to tell us more about the musicians and the music. Hi there.
Hello there, Robin. How are you?
I'm fine. Estamos Gozando. We are...
We're enjoying ourselves. We're having a great time.
And so we are. And Plena Libre, the band, I know that plena is a kind of a rhythm. Tell us more.
Well, it has its origins back in the end of the 19th century, somewhere in the southern part of Puerto Rico, Ponce, or in the northeastern part, Loíza. In any case, there's talk that there was some influence from immigrants from Barbados who then immigrated to the island of Puerto Rico, and their style, their song repertoire mixed in over time, came together with the genres that were already there in Puerto Rico that had strong African influence, and thus came what is now known as plena. And what makes this very special for me in particular is that this is one of the most traditional folkloric styles of music played in the island. And on this particular CD, what Plena Libre has done, not only are they celebrating the 10th anniversary, they've put together some of the repertoire of some of the great planas and some of the great artists who have put this music together throughout the years. And so this makes it a very, very special tribute to the art form.
And as we should note, special to you and people like you because you're from Puerto Rico.
Yes. And so a lot of these songs remind me of my youth, remind me of everything what plena represents. The lyrics for plena in many ways are similar to a newspaper. Imagine, if you will, we didn't have a newspaper and no way of us reading what's going on, but we have a song that tells us every day what the different occurrences are throughout the different towns, from the tragedies to the good news to the celebrations, and that's what plena does. So when you hear the lyrics, you know that there is a story to tell.
Well, let's hear a little and tell us the story being told.
The first one we heard was Olvídalo, which means forget about it. If you don't love me, well, forget about it. I'll love somebody else. But this one is titled Qué Buenas Son Las Mujeres, and it was originally recorded by one of the great plena players from the island, a gentleman who had a big band by the name of Cesar Concepcion. And this featured Charlie Sepulveda on trumpet, Qué Buenas Son Las Mujeres. It talks about how great women are.
Qué buenas son las mujeres, eso lo sabemos ya. Ellas son las que nos hacen la vida buena y dulzona. Sabe ponernos celosos y hasta nos hacen pelear. Buenas son cuando nos quieren, esa es la pura verdad.
Qué buenas son las mujeres. How great are the women? I can get down with that. By Plena Libre, the Puerto Rican group. And Jose Maso, I know that Plena also has certain kinds of drums.
Yes, they're called panderos, and they're similar to tambourines. As we know, tambourines, mm-hmm. Round wooden. And there's three different drums, each one pitched to a different sound from low to high. So you have what's called the seguidor, which is the biggest, and it's the deepest sound, which would be the bass drum, which is the one that sets the foundation, the rhythmic foundation. Then you have a mid-pitch drum, which is el punteador, and then the highest pitch is the requinto, which not only continues the rhythm, but is also known as the solo instrument. And that's the rhythm that you hear throughout these different selections.
Let's hear another one.
This next selection is a tribute to one of the greatest and one of my favorite, Rafael Cortijo and his combo. During the 1950s and 1960s, this was the group that did a couple of things. They broke, first and foremost, what we would call the color barrier, if you will, in the sense that this was a group of Afro-Puerto Ricans from the island who made it very big everywhere. And they were known and have been known as the premier group that made this rhythm popular.
So are you saying they broke the color barrier, if you will, in Puerto Rico as well? Because they were darker skinned Puerto Ricans.
Yes. At that time, this type of popular music form was very popular with the working class. And so, therefore, if you went to the great ballrooms, be they in Puerto Rico, Cuba, Panama, anywhere where the Spanish-speaking countries, you would usually find bands that were reflective of either the strong Spanish influence from Spain or reflective of whatever they were getting from the United States, the big band sounds of the Count Basie Orchestra or mm-hmm. Tommy Dorsey or Glenn Miller and those types of things. And so now this group all of a sudden broke out of the pop in the sense of the working class and the masses so that everyone embraced them, and they were able to then go into those clubs and to television and to radio at times when folks like this were not able to do so.
So we're hearing about two groups now. Here is Plena Libre's tribute to a Rafael Cortijo, and you say the title because you say it so much better.
Tributo a Rafael Cortijo y su combo.
Again, Plena Libre and their tribute to another great Puerto Rican musician, Rafael Cortijo. I understand, Jose Maso, that this music it can be as simple as a couple of people singing, but it also can be huge and orchestral.
Yes, it can. And what they've done is that they've added not only the traditional accordion from time to time and the cuatro guitar, but also trombones, piano, the whole nine yards. This next selection we're going to hear is an instrumental titled Lluvia con Nieve, which features a pianist by the name of Luis Marin, Roberto Rueda Bongo, Alfredo de la Fe on the violin, and Charlie Sepulveda on trumpet. And so it's more of a dance tune in the instrumental sound of the Plena. And it was originally recorded by another great planero by the name of Mon Rivera. Lluvia, which means rain, con nieve, which means snow. So rain and snow. Lluvia con nieve.
Rain and snow. Jose Maso, thank you so much for introducing us to Plena Libre. Do you feel like you've been home a little bit?
It always takes me home to hear music like this, and in particular this CD, because as I said before, it pays tribute to some of the great masters of this musical genre of plena from the island of Puerto Rico.
Jose, thanks.
My pleasure.
Here now is impassioned Latin music critic Jose Maso introducing us to Plena Libre and their new album, Estamos Gozando. Anoche en el baile charlatán, me diste a mi lola.
and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
Join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.